Welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes, 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland and Labrador, 9 p.m. in London and Dublin, 9 p.m. on the vexatious Irish border, which is causing such consternation in the corridors of power as they count down to the final Brexit deadline. 10 p.m. in Brussels, where the duplicitous Continentals are just completing their screw-over of the Brits on Brexit. And beyond that, it's, what is it, 11 p.m. in Moscow, and I think midnight 30 in Tehran, and the early hours of Thursday morning in Asia and the Pacific. But wherever you are, welcome to another of our Clubland Q&As. You know the way this works. Anyone can listen to it, and we hope you are listening to it. If you want to ask a question, you have to be a Mark Stein Club member. If you join right now, I'll make a special point of getting to your question before the show is out. You'll also be able to come along to some of the special members-only events that we're hosting next month, and we would love to see you there at. Anyway, shoot me a question on any of the things we've been talking about in the last few days. We are counting down not only to the big Brexit deadline, but to the Canadian election, in which the world's wokest mammy singer, one would have to bet at the moment that his chances of surviving might be better than expected for a guy who can't reliably tell you how many times he's appeared in blackface in the 21st century. 185 years ago today, happy anniversary, the Houses of Parliament at Westminster burned. And they were rebuilt by the great architect Sir Charles Barry, who built my old school. He built a lot of great buildings, the Palace of Westminster among them, after the Houses of Parliament burned 185 years ago today, October 16th, 1834. My old Telegraph colleague Matt Ridley makes the point that Parliament started to burn and crowds gathered not to extinguish the flames but to cheer, as who wouldn't? If you saw the United States Congress burning, if you saw the Houses of Parliament in Ottawa burning, if you saw that to my mind, terribly attractive new Parliament House in Canberra in Australia burning, there are all kinds of legislatures where the healthy reaction to them being on fire would be to stand around and cheer. But they actually did that 185 years ago. More importantly, it's International Pronouns Day. I was sent, which I think we might actually post at Stein Online afterwards. I was sent a particularly ludicrous tweet from DCC Julie Cook of the Cheshire Constabulary in England, who leads the, I don't believe this, she's head of the LGBT plus portfolio for the National Police Chiefs, and she's advising us that on International Pronouns Day, she's seeking to make sharing, educating, and respecting personal pronouns commonplace. This is what the useless British police... I don't think that there are few institutions on the planet that I despise more, I'm afraid, than the British police. Years ago, when I lived in London, they were just like, I preferred the old school bent coppers of the Metropolitan Police. You always had to be a bit careful if you used the gents at the at Piccadilly Circus, because you'd go in there and you'd be in there standing at the pissoir, and some burly fellow in a white polo neck sweater and tight jeans, but with the giveaway policeman boots sticking out of the Soho rent boy look, would come and stand at the adjoining urinal and make eyes at you, trying to entrap. I preferred the old bent Metropolitan Police than the new woke Metropolitan Police, because they're woke and bent. And that's like a stupid that's like the world's worst combination for coppers. Anyway, it's International Pronouns Day, and it's being celebrated by the LGBTQ whatever representative of the Cheshire Constabulary. And people say, what is this sharing pronouns? You don't, it's everywhere now. The Democrat candidates are doing it. Kamala Harris came out and shared her pronouns. She said, my pronouns are she, her, and hers, I think she said. And at which point, Chris Cuomo agreed. He said mine too. So he was making a joke that he uses female pronouns. Cheap joke. But he had to back down and apologise. Otherwise he'd be out of work. He'd be finished. He had to issue a grovelling apology explaining how seriously he took the whole pronouns issue. This is Fredo. Fredo Cuomo, the guy who was getting in some guy's face about being called Fredo, threatening to beat him up. And it turns out he's just a big panty-waist, wussy, girly boy milk toast when it comes to pronoun sharing, like everybody else. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez vowing not to have children because of climate change. Nevertheless, and I'm all for that. I'm happy for if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wants to have her tubes tied, go for it, girl. But she wants before she could tie the tubes, she had to share the pronouns of the children she'll never have: he, she, or they. She was going to have a non-binary child, but she's going to deny us the benefit of her non-binary progeny, because she doesn't want to bring more people into a world that is facing climate catastrophe. We joke about these things. Now we have police forces, Democrat presidential candidates, and the British police are taking pronoun sharing seriously. All the people, you might find it funny, but all the people who matter in our world don't find it funny. And as I always say, you know, while so-called conservatives are getting excited about a corporate tax cut, the left is busy abolishing the two sexes and replacing them with 57 genders. I get tired of people. You know, I remember when this thing started, and I mentioned it on Rush, and somebody said, why are you talking about this, Stein? This isn't important. You know, who wins the primary for the 157th congressional district in Iowa is more important. No, it isn't. The left just got on and abolished the two sexes. And as I said, we now have the police, state power, taking it seriously, and we have Democrat presidential candidates taking it seriously. Tired of the right playing small ball. Small ball. Small ball all the time. It's all they, you know, it's pathetic. It's all they do. It's a complete waste of time. Okay, let's get to your questions, which have been pouring in. Actually, that first one was from Laura Rosen-Cohen, wishing me a happy International Pronouns Day. And wants to know, how are you identifying yourself lately? Do you know, I find it harder and harder to identify myself when I wake up in the morning. It's getting more and more difficult. Like this morning I woke up and I really couldn't identify myself until lunchtime. It's getting worse and worse. Kate Smythe writes, Mark, you've noted that China, enabled by the West, has developed, quote, the only economically viable form of communism, despite its looming demographic decline, a stark contrast with the rise of global Islam. China's influence is being projected globally in all manner of ways, including people power. And The Claws of the Red Dragon, Steve Bannon's film, is a disturbing glimpse of a near future in which its cyber dominance supersedes its vast military power. Add to this the fact that Sinophobia has joined Islamophobia and transphobia on the West's diverse list of offences which necessitate the curtailment of free speech. How is all of this likely to play out, in your view? Well, that's a super big question for starters, Kate. Anything that isn't Islamic has a problem with Islam. That includes the West, that includes Russia, that includes India, and it also includes China, where, as you know, they've basically put a million Uyghurs in concentration camps. I think the New York Times had a headline the other day, "What is a Uyghur?" Well, if you'd just been listening to me on Rush over a decade ago when we used to do our Uyghur Wednesday jokes after Obama released four Uyghurs from Gitmo to Bermuda, and then I mentioned that I'd seen them crossing the road in St. George's, you'd know that you would not be like a New York Times reader, and you would know entirely what a Uyghur is. So everybody has their problems with Islam, but China has concluded that it's not a problem for them. You know, we talk about Islamophobia is a serious thing in the West, but China can get away with sticking a million Uyghurs in a concentration camp, and one or two Republicans raise the issue. I can't recall a Democrat ever raising the issue. They get annoyed about my Islamophobia, but the Chinese Politburo jailing a million Muslims is nothing to them. So the Chinese figure that they can keep this the West's problem for a while. China is not a resource-rich power, which is why it has to annex the resources of other places, such as Africa, actually, in fact, Australia to one degree or another, to the Caribbean and Canada and elsewhere. And China has a long strategic plan. And they're serious about that in a way. We don't have a plan, and if we had a plan, we wouldn't be serious about it anyway. We live in the moment. We live in the present tense, and we think the present tense is forever. China doesn't. And China has dramatically changed in the last 35 years, and we think that change has no significance, that it's our world, and China just lives in it, to modify an old headline, and that it will always be our world. One of the interesting things about the left, as much as they profess all this rubbish about multiculturalism, is they don't actually mean it. None of them want to live in anything but an advanced, developed Western society. None of them do. And yet all this virtue signaling and the frisson of multiculturalism and all the rest of it will actually contribute to ending the world they want to live in, and will ensure that that China inherits by default. China is serious in a way that we are not. And you see that when they smack down something like the NBA. The difference, the National Basketball Association, the difference in the way when the National Basketball Association do their virtue signaling about something in America, everyone defers to them. When they do it about something in China, the Chinese Politburo slap them down and they kowtow. And it tells you something about the seriousness with which China... Everyone assumes the Chinese are just sort of insecure and it's all about face and all the rest of it. It's not. It's about being a serious nation. It's about being a serious nation with a long-term plan. If nothing else, note the absence of any seriousness and any long-term strategy on our part. Kitty Bits writes, "Dear Mark, please give an update on the victims of the grooming gangs in the UK. Why are the British people tolerating this? Has it been stopped? Would it help if someone made a documentary about it and put it on a platform for public consumption? Maybe the Brits are self-conscious enough to be ashamed of allowing their girls to be abused this way if the whole world can see it. What is happening with Tommy Robinson? I wish he could bring his family here," I assume that's to America, "as a real refugee. I'd be willing to sponsor them." I'm not really interested in the whole refugee thing for Tommy Robinson or for anyone else, really, because I don't think we should be at the stage where people should be fleeing and coming to America. I think it's important to actually save parts of the rest of the world. I don't agree with that, actually, just on Iraq or Afghanistan, where we're now having to, you know, take the people who made the mistake of cooperating with us 15 years ago now, more than 15 years ago, almost 20 years ago in Iraq and Afghanistan, The Western presence wanes, and as the old forces reassert themselves, if you made the mistake of collaborating with the US and its allies in 2001 and 2003, now they have to be brought over here as refugees. I regret this. I think the best way to make other places less troublesome in the world, I don't think taking all the sane people out of there helps, and that's true both for Afghanistan and for the United Kingdom. So I'd rather that Tommy Robinson stayed and fought the good fight, although I would understand it if he felt differently about it. As for the grooming gangs, you know, no one's surprised now. Telford, I mentioned Telford, I wrote about Telford, and I sort of called Britain the United Cuckdom, because not because I like the phrase cuck as applied to cuckservatives and all the rest of it, but that I think you can apply it to an entire society that it is willing to have its maidenhood, such as it is in Britain, slaughtered on the altar of multiculturalism. In other words, if you'll sacrifice your daughters, what won't you sacrifice? And Rotherham was supposed to be an isolated case, and then we discovered that it's also Oxford and Rochdale and Leeds and Telford in Shropshire. And I thought Telford was an interesting case because it's a new town. They had a policy in Britain in the 1960s of creating new towns. So they take like four or five little rural villages and put a big ring road around it and create a whole new town. And that's what they did in Telford in Shropshire, birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. So the whole place only goes back 40 years, 40, no, that's, no, a little more than that, 50 years. But essentially, if you look at the earliest cases of the groomings when it was exposed in Telford, the thing has basically been rotten more or less since the first Pakistani immigrants arrived there in the 70s. And when I say people feel their daughters are being sacrificed, you know, if you're willing to sacrifice your daughters, what won't you sacrifice? The problem, of course, is people don't see it like that. People don't see it like that. And you have to think of the grip that multiculturalism holds on a society for them to go ahead with and in a sense anaesthetize themselves to what was done to these girls. And as I've said, I spent a fair bit of time with the young ladies in Rotherham who are all terribly damaged. Even the ones who haven't actually been dangled over balconies or doused in petrol and threatened to be set alight are profoundly damaged just because they've been made to shag like dozens of blokes in one evening for years on end. That's bound to damage you. And the heartlessness, not just of the British media, but of the British public, which I think is in part out of a sense of shame, and they disguise it. In other words, one of the reasons for this is that no one is unloved in contemporary British iconography as these white working class girls at towns all over England. Because the Muslims in the grooming gangs who preyed on them despised them as they were just white slags, as they put it. But the police and the social services and the politicians also all took the same view. And so do all the Jeremys and Nigels in the Fleet Street media. The media don't care for them because they're sort of white working class trash and are thought to be of no value. And this contempt, I think it's one of the most shameful things ever. It's still going on. And actually, I saw it going on. Because one of the young ladies told me they're now whatever they were 28, 30 or whatever, and they told me it's still going on. They've got daughters, the daughters, because they had their daughter children fairly young, the daughters are 12, 14 or whatever, and they're being preyed upon, and they named shopping centres and things that it's still going on at, and nobody cares. And it's worth thinking about how the grip that the cult of multiculturalism has, that even your most primal instincts, and there's nothing more basic to a society than the urge of men to protect their women folk. We've destroyed all that. One thing these girls have in common is that very often they're raised in houses where the fathers are absent, and they live sort of transient, conditional lives in which mum takes up with some new bloke every couple of years, whatever. But you notice the absence of stable lives, and we tell ourselves, oh, single mothers are heroes and they're inspiring and all the rest of it. We've actually obliterated the conventional family model, and we think that has no consequences. The consequences may be good, the consequences may be bad, but you can't think you can do it and for there not to be consequences. And one of the consequences, a great evil that you see in the British media indifference to this story and the reluctance to confront the truth about what it says about thousands of girls, shows that even something as primal and essential to society as a man's instinct to protect the women of his community can be evaporated. Brian from Minneapolis says, "Dear Mark, I know you're tired of the NBA and China story as much as I do, but I needed to get it out there. The truth of what is revealed behind LeBron and others in the NBA siding with China isn't just about the money, but the message that they're sending, that what is happening in America is far more important than what's going on in China. Who cares about Hong Kong protesters' civil liberties and lives when police suppression, transgender rights, climate change, and other progressive think tank issues are the real problems that we should worry about? I don't care who the NBA does business with, but as a company, when you take a stance on social and political issues and only say that they apply to the US and not China, it makes you a poser, never willing to risk anything of value in the fight for their cause. Your thoughts, Mark?" Yeah, you're right. But that's because these issues are not, these are not good faith issues. They're cudgels. Again, multiculturalism, to come back to what we were talking about, isn't about celebrating all cultures. It's about denigrating your own. It's about doing down your own. So transgender bathrooms or climate change, it follows naturally that the most evil perpetrators of transphobia or planetary eco-destruction are going to be the West. And that's why nobody, the Yangtze is the world's longest toilet. And nobody cares. Nobody cares. I had that twit on with me on Rush a few weeks back, who's concerned about polluting the oceans. America makes no significant contribution to polluting the ocean, nor does Canada, nor does any Western European nation. You know why? Because we have like this, we have municipal garbage disposal. And the pollution of the oceans is caused by 10 nations, mainly concentrated, with the exception of Egypt and one or two others, mainly concentrated in Southeast Asia, South Asia. Bangladesh is there on the list. Nobody cares, because climate change is a way to do down Western capitalism. That's its purpose. Nobody cares about imposing on China the same virtue signaling that Americans and Europeans and so forth are required to engage in. And that leads naturally. Now, China is an evil, it's, as I said, it's a serious country. It's also a seriously evil country. I'm renowned as a notorious Islamophobe, but I don't think you should have the right to stick a million Uyghurs in re-education camp when they've done nothing wrong. But again, it's exactly the same thing. What matters is an American or a Canadian or a Scotsman or a Dutchman being Islamophobic. Nobody cares. The Chinese can be as Islamophobic as they want. These are not good faith issues. And when Brian says that that makes these people posers, of course they are. Of course, that's absolutely what they are. Because the whole point of it is to do down bourgeois values, as we used to call them, in North America and the rest of the Western world. Nobody cares about China. And so, but the money point also comes into play as well. What we have done, Kate Smythe reminded me of my old line that we'd help the Chinese find the only economically viable form of communism. Now, that didn't matter for the first few years, first half decade or so, when a lot of Chinese got brought out of poverty and it was possible to tell oneself that having everything that's in your house, having everything in the average American's house made in China is essentially a beneficial act, a paternalistic act, taking the great benefits of capitalism that Americans used to enjoy and instead closing down the factories here and giving all those benefits to people in China is a kindly act, is a beneficial act. No, it isn't. What we have done is we have made a great tyranny part, an indispensable part of the global economy. We did something that Lenin and Stalin couldn't accomplish, that Marx would never have expected and Engels would never have expected to accomplish. In 1917, you have the Russian Revolution, communists are installed in power. They want to make the world communist and they can't do it. And at the end of the 1980s, the whole racket collapses except China. And instead of letting China collapse, we instead decided to so endow China with business that we made them now a critical part of the global economy. According to how you do it, they're either the number two global economy or vying for number one. And so what that means is that for something as piffling and irrelevant as this LeBron guy, some twerp basketball player, a guy who, you know, gets enormously well. He has the American thing, the capitalist thing. You can become enormously wealthy doing something of no consequence, importance to anyone. So you're like bouncing a ball around on the floor and you become enormously wealthy. And we now have a situation where all the most powerful elements of the global economy are also tied into China. You see it in motion pictures where Hollywood makes films that appeal to young men sitting in Asian multiplexes. And likewise, so annoying Beijing becomes a problem. So we, in fact, have the exact opposite of what all the clever people, all the Council for Foreign Relations and all these people told us. Oh, well, you know, if you make China capitalist, you can't have a capitalist economy without democracy. So simply by making them wealthy, you will create a push for democracy that will be irresistible. So we will liberate China by giving them all our business. And in fact, the exact opposite is happening. We now have rich, wealthy Americans who are happy to be shills for a dictatorial, brutal, evil Chinese dictatorship. Because we haven't managed to make China a beacon of liberty, but China is managing to douse liberty in the West. Thanks a lot, Council of Foreign Relations geniuses. What's your next idea? Alman from CA. Mark, thank God you are here. That's California, I believe, not Canada. Mark, thank God you are here to get my mind right. I'm very confused. The left, including the mainstream media, now considers everything President Trump does as an existential threat. So who will the left end up endorsing in the Middle East after this Syria pullout? The left loved Turkey when Obama and Erdogan palled around and Mrs. Erdogan was made out to be a happy hijab lady. I think actually, I think that's the fella who was president of Morsi. I think that was Mrs. Morsi who was happy in her hijab in Egypt. But now Turkey is going after the communist, I think, Kurds. So the Kurds are aligning with Syria to fight Turkey. Syria is aligned with Russia, who the left used to love as the Soviet Union, but now hate since Hillary lost because Orangeman bad. Iran is there creating chaos. The left loves them because Obama loved them, and they now pull strings in Iraq. Help! Best regards from Al Mann from California. Al, you know, that's like, I asked a question on Rush a couple of days ago when I was guest hosting for Rush. I said, whose side are we on in Syria? Nobody can actually say. Lindsey Graham, when he complained about the Chinese pullout, says, well, this will be emboldening Assad. This will be emboldening Turkey. This will be emboldening ISIS. And I think this will be emboldening Iran. All these people hate each other. They're not on four different sides. They're on three different sides, at least. So it might embolden one. That might do something against the, these are all enemies of each other. These are all enemies of each other. Whose side are we on there? And now I like Kurds. And in fact, I think one of people say, well, the Iraq war was a waste of time and everything. One of the great things that came out about it is that Kurdistan is basically, Iraqi Kurdistan is basically the Quebec of Iraq, or it's the Irish Free State of Iraq. It's not, it doesn't have the full powers of a sovereign state, but it has more powers than mere provinces or regions have. And from that, it might well, it's guarded that autonomous devolved government that it benefits from since the toppling of Saddam very zealously. I think actually one of the best things that could happen would be if the Syrian Kurds would be to do a similar deal with Assad. He might be ready to do that. Are we capable of actually negotiating all the nuances of something like that? No, obviously we're not. All the experts are know-nothings. Lindsey Graham's late friend John McCain, he flew over there. He was had his photograph taken with a couple of people who he thinks are great friends of liberty. He thinks they can't wait to sit down and be the Jefferson and Madison of Syria. And next thing you know, it turns out they're affiliates of ISIS. We're chumps trying to negotiate the subtleties of that part of the world. But I will say that what happened in Iraq, the creation of an autonomous Kurdistan for Iraqi Kurdistan, could be done in Syria, couldn't be done in Turkey at the present. But that's the only Kurdistan that's on offer. You're not going to get the whole of Kurdistan in Turkey, Iraq, Syria, all to form one big country. Dream on. That's not going to happen. So the question then is, what's the purpose of what's going on there? I mean, for me, it's just a cudgel to beat Trump with. And its main interest, why the Democrats are going along with it, is because they understand that the Lindsey Graham branch of the interventionists, the boots on the ground, and actually if you were to look at the planet from outer space, most of the globe is covered with American boots on the ground. It's all you can see from outer space. It's obscuring the views of the mountains and lakes. Just American boots on the ground all over the map at the behest of people like Lindsey Graham. The question then is, that's a serious thing. Trump doing what he did in Syria is a serious thing. And to me, it's mainly of interest. If this sort of backstage Potemkin pseudo-ersatz impeachment actually became a real thing, and the House voted to impeach, and it then went to the Senate to convict, the Democrats are going to have to pull away a chunk of Republican senators to actually remove Trump from office. And that interventionist side, intervention without strategy, intervention without national interest, intervention without serious goals, that's a pretty big chunk of the mainstream Republican Party, and it might entirely be possible to pull away a few of them to actually to remove Trump from office. That's its main. That's the only reason everyone is, oh, Kurdish this, Kurdish that, Kurds, Syrians, Iranians, Kurds, Turks. You know, no, none of these people know anything about it. It's just a cudgel, and it's just a cudgel to beat Trump with. Arnold Gray writes, "Hey Mark, do you have any thoughts about Chelsea Clinton and Michelle Obama threatening to enter politics?" I wouldn't put those in quite the same category, Arnold. I think whatever you feel about Michelle Obama, she has a certain charisma. Chelsea is a charisma-free zone. And I think back when she was a little girl, not a terribly, she was a rather plain little girl. And John McCain, we seem to be talking about him a lot, he made a bad taste joke about Chelsea Clinton. He stood up. This is, again, I can't believe it. The people that Washington admires, this guy stands up, McCain, in front of an open mic, and he says, why, he tells this joke at some event in Washington, circa, my best guess would be 1997. And he goes, why is Chelsea Clinton so ugly? Because her real father's Janet Reno. So at a stroke, John McCain, the so-called reach across the aisle guy, has said that the president's daughter is ugly, her mother is a lesbian, and his attorney general is a man in drag. That's John McCain reaching across the aisle. Anyway, and as usual, all the media, all the people who liked John McCain because he would reach across the aisle to screw over Republicans, covered up that joke. Maureen Dowd at the New York Times actually wrote a column without saying what the joke was. And artfully tap dancing around it, because they basically agreed to cover up the offensiveness of the joke because they wished to preserve McCain's viability as this guy who'd screw the Republicans. So I was actually revolted by the sight of a media that covers issues without honestly addressing them, which was unusual then. It's now a regular thing. We see it with the Charlie Hebdo thing, where they all do these. Oh, these poor chaps who had such courage at this power. They believe what they said. They died for the principle of free speech and press freedom. Oh, that's fascinating. Could we actually see what it is that they were doing that got them killed? Oh, no. We can't show you that. It would be grossly insensitive. Anyway, this was an early example of it. And I wrote about it in The Spectator, this awful joke that McCain had told. And I said that actually I thought this was rather unfair to young Chelsea because I thought she was rather a fetching filly, I believe was the phrase I used in The Spectator. And the New York Post and other people picked up on it and had this little excerpt. It was a sort of as the quote of the week or whatever it was. And I meant it. She seemed a pleasant little girl. Well, the little girl grew up and she became a big, entitled, tone-deaf, nothing of a person. Who said that one of the reasons she decided to go to work for the Clinton Foundation was that she decided money wasn't important to her. Well, that's easy for her to say. She got paid a third of $1 million a year or whatever it was to do a non-job at NBC where she barely got on air. So she basically, I think she had two stories on air. So she basically earned $175,000 for her two-minute news story. She had no talent for it. She marries some rich guy and she's getting all the money that the Clintons made in their years after leaving office. And she lives in a penthouse on Central Park West or wherever it is. Bigger than most houses that Americans live in to you know, five times the size. So it's easy for her to say, oh, and then I decided I didn't need money, so I'd go to work for the Clinton Foundation, whose entire purpose is to enable the three members of the Clinton family to have essentially the expenses and retinue of a head of state passed off as some kind of charitable endeavor. She's no good at that. She's not even good at sitting alongside her mother in these book interviews for the lousy book that they didn't write. She's superfluous to that. In the 20 years ago, when Hillary was doing It Takes a Village, it only took one no-talent Clinton not to write the book. Now it takes two no-talent Clintons to not write a Clinton book. Chelsea Clinton, if you think Hillary doesn't have the instincts of Bill, the only talent in the family, if you think Hillary doesn't have the instincts of Bill, Chelsea doesn't have the instincts of Hillary. She isn't going to go anywhere. Go, bring it on. Bring it on. It's like all these things. It's like the Joseph Patrick Kennedy V, who's running for Congress in Massachusetts. These are like photocopies of a photocopy of a photocopy of old Joe Kennedy, or a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of Bill Clinton. The talent is fading, fading, fading. And in the Clintons, it's actually fading faster because it was basically a one-man operation than it does with the Kennedys. Michael Covino says, Mark, regarding America's permanent coup, one thing nearly all of the media fails to note is that if Trump had not won the election, we would never know the extent to which the NSA, CIA, FBI, and others in government agencies attempted to meddle in the 2016 election by conducting surveillance on various Trump associates and their campaign. Frankly, what we have learned so far is worse than Watergate. Yet I find it interesting the Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee has not conducted a Church Committee like a set of hearings as we saw in the 1970s. Do it publicly and force the mainstream media to air the dirty laundry of the deep state. What are they waiting for? It is time to put Brennan, Comey, Clapper, McCabe under oath and subject to the same legal jeopardy that General Flynn and others in the Trump orbit have endured. What has set this nation apart for over 200 years, sans the Civil War, is the losing party accepting their losses at the polls and doing the people's business thereafter. Yet the Dem resistance remains fixated on the 2016 election. But I guess I'm not surprised, since the Dems have not accepted a Republican winning the White House since 1988. Recall the 2000 Florida fiasco and Kerry claiming Bush stole Ohio in 2004. Great piece on Bond villain Blofeld last week. I laughed the whole way through. Actually, I pine for Blofeld-like villains in hollowed-out volcanoes because they're easier to get a grip on in the public imagination than what is going on inside the so-called intelligence community. Which ought to be deeply disturbing. And I find it interesting. For example, Trey Gowdy, who was a brilliant prosecutor and then became a brilliant forensic questioner as a member of Congress. You know, we elect, as far as I can tell, the United States Congress doesn't actually legislate anything anymore. They're elected merely to serve as a pseudo courtroom, and they're not very good at it. And so you have these like showboating tosspots who have a witness in front of them and instead give some bleeding heart, ineffectual speech about this and that and use up their time. Gowdy isn't like that. He was an effective prosecutor, so he asks highly forensic questions designed to extract damaging answers from the witnesses, which is why President Trump has just basically attempted to sign him as his attorney in some of these impeachment shenanigans. But it's interesting to me that actually Gowdy thinks almost all of what the FBI and these other agencies did in the last few years has been entirely legitimate. Gowdy, Trey Gowdy, who is a sharp guy, but he's essentially okay with these phony baloney Pfizer warrants, with the McCabe behavior, with going to jail for misremembering to the FBI. He doesn't seriously challenge the premise of the investigation and the powers, the extraordinary powers, powers that shouldn't really exist in a free society, and if they do exist, should be used very sparingly, are being applied to the Trump campaign. And I think this is a difficult one for the right, because the right is generally supportive. I mean, for example, these Pfizer court shenanigans, this is a rubber stamp court, and we were assured by the likes of Lindsey Graham in the wake of 9/11 that its powers would never be used against US citizens. In fact, that rationale for going along with these Pfizer court powers, the rubber stamp judges, the lack of representation by the Carter Page, for example, he's we know he's not a spy. He's not a spy at all. He might be doing business in countries that you think he shouldn't be doing business in. You might prefer it if he was running a feed store in some rinky-dink town in the middle of nowhere. But in fact, he's not a spy. And so he's been under surveillance for years now because of the Pfizer court. He can't go. There's no, some of the most basic protections going back to Magna Carta, the right to confront your accuser in open court, are denied to Carter Page. Every time the Pfizer court just rubber stamps another 3 months of surveillance on him, he's not in there. He doesn't have a lawyer. The other side of the courtroom, the defense side of the courtroom, is empty. And we were assured by Lindsey, oh, don't worry, Lindsey Graham and all that side. Oh, don't worry, this is just necessary. It's going to be guys sitting in a cave in Tora Bora plotting something. They're the ones that this thing's for. And it's if they're calling cousin Ahmed back in America that that's why we need the Pfizer court powers. And turns out instead they used it to set up the ruling party and its ideological supporters in the permanent bureaucracy used the cover of a counter-surveillance operation, which is meant to be used against foreigners, to backdoor their way into the campaign of their political opponent. It's disgraceful, and Republican and those Republicans who basically are happy for the permanent security state to have unlimited powers are not the friends of liberty, and they can quote the United States Constitution and the First Amendment and the Second Amendment and all the other amendments to their heart's content, but they actually have a duty to profoundly rethink that. Robert Stewart writes, Mark, George Papadopoulos's experience makes it apparent that the interest in infiltrating, suborning, or embarrassing the Trump campaign dates back to about the time he announced his candidacy in mid-2015. There were six or seven other fairly competent Republican politicians who had also announced their candidacy at that time. I think a little more, in fact, Robert. And the expectation was that Trump was not likely to make it very far. This feeling was particularly true amongst the deep state elite. If Trump was targeted for special tricks, isn't it likely that the more conventional candidates would have been also included in the target list? Well, the most interesting aspect of that, Robert, is actually that Papadopoulos, if I recall correctly, at one point he couldn't get into the Trump campaign and he went to the Ben Carson campaign. And his view is that the Carson campaign was also of interest to these deep state spooks. So you may be right, and it may be that they're just so out of control then they're actually getting in to everybody's camp. Carson, to be fair, was also a sort of outsider candidate at that time. And maybe that's just the insider's reaction to outsiders. Robert continues, I think we are making a mistake if we treat all that we have learned of corruption within the DOJ and the intelligence agencies as unique and applying only to Trump. The organisation that has been exposed in the treatment of Papadopoulos suggests a modus operandi that involved a lot of actors from Malta to Australia to FBI agents, all willing to play an active role in this conspiracy. The depth of corruption wouldn't be visible to any single actor in this little drama. Each could assume it was just business as usual. Another opportunity for Alexander Downer to have a couple of drinks with the fetching Erica Thompson at the Kensington Wine Room, all paid for by the company, and oh yes, chat up some nobody who needs a course correction and who might say something that might prove to be usefully embarrassing. That being the case, the apparatus could have been used on any number of other targets. We haven't learned about them because their candidate didn't become the nominee, so there was no need to pull the trigger. Sidney Powell discovered that the dirty tricks that were used on Senator Ted Stevens were standard operating procedure in the Merrill Lynch prosecution 5 years earlier. I would expect the same Brady violations were also part of the Conrad Black case. Are we just seeing the tip of the iceberg? I would agree with a lot of that. I think if you were to put a benign construction on what Alexander Downer was doing at the Kensington Wine Rooms, other than just having a drink with Erica Thompson and some nobody, it would be that the people who are pitching you to get you to participate in this, and this I think would be true for Joseph Mifsud, who is a known MI6 asset and I think almost certainly a CIA asset. He's the Maltese guy who was a professor, I believe, at Queen's University in Belfast. There's a lot of British subjects, all Maltese, Australian, English, all comes round to that, in part because they're the closest allies under the Five Eyes agreement, but also because all the people who were pitching who were pitching the story are people who do actually have connections with the CIA and the FBI. So they're not rogue. The first thing Peter Strzok did, for example, when he got into the so-called investigation, was to fly to London to meet with Alexander Downer. And Strzok didn't know what a High Commissioner was. He didn't know what Australia House was in London. He doesn't I've explained this before, that because Australia and Britain aren't foreign to each other, the Queen of Australia doesn't exchange ambassadors with the Queen of the United Kingdom. So they have high commissioners. And in fact, the Australia House, as in that sense, as Downer pointed out to Peter Strzok, is the oldest permanent diplomatic facility, unchanging diplomatic facility in London. Because all the others are moved all the time, and Australia House is still in Australia House. And so Peter Strzok's, this is the first meeting Peter Strzok has when he's appointed to the so-called Russia investigation. And so Peter Strzok's sitting opposite the desk from Alexander Downer. Now, Downer knows that Peter Strzok works for the FBI, that he's the highest counterintelligence guy in the FBI. So why wouldn't he think this is all on the up and up? It couldn't be more up. It's gone to the top. It's gone to the top. And so I'm not surprised by this, and I do agree with you. I think Federer, and again, it's a difficult thing, and I get a bit tired about this because you see all the, it's a great recurring line of Sean Hannity. Oh, everybody, I've known law enforcement, FBI guys are great guys, it's the rank and file, blah, 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 blah. All that may be true. But the rottenness, as you say, the rottenness of federal justice at the highest level is known from the Ted Stevens case, from the Conrad Black case, actually the Martha Stewart case. A whole rotten edifice needs destroying. Leslie B. writes, "Hi, Mark. Rod Little recently commented that he thinks we are at, I don't know, can I say this? Take your children out." He says he thinks Rod Little recently commented that we are at peak wank with transgendered issues. Do you agree, or do we still have a long wanky road ahead of us? I am afraid, Leslie, that no matter how wanky you you think we are, we can always get wankier. The point about the whole, the transgendered thing is actually interesting to me because the left won on same-sex marriage, and that's an incredible achievement to define an institution, redefine an institution that predates most all sovereign states on the planet. And so they, you would think after having pulled off something like that, they'd all want to go to the Bahamas for a couple of weeks and unwind. And instead, they just stampede on to the next thing, which is the transgendered thing. And it's interesting to me, we talked about it earlier with this pronouns thing. At a certain level, it's rubbish because the number of people who are homosexual is a tiny percentage. The Kinsey report said it's 1 in 10. I think I saw a thing in Toronto decades ago that it was 1 in 7. That may be special to Toronto. And everyone else says, actually, when you boil it all down, it's 2%. It's not as... that in fact Kinsey overestimated it. Okay, so we're talking about 2% or 10%, whatever you want to call it. But the transgendered thing is even tinier, even tinier percentage of that. So when you have mainstream Democrat candidates, people who are serious about wanting to be president of the United States, Kamala Harris, and she feels obliged to announce her gender pronouns, when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the most powerful and influential figure in the new Democrat Party, says she wants to, feels the need. Something big is underfoot. One of the things that may or may not be relevant about it is at a certain level, for example, the Rainbow Coalition has its inherent contradictions. So, for example, the secular Western left likes homosexuals, whereas the average fire-breathing imam wants to throw them off the roof of a tall building, put them in a cage and set them on fire, or do as they did in Afghanistan, construct a wall and then crush the homosexual beneath the wall. These are conflicting positions. And if one were to look at it in a strategic sense, something like this transgender thing is actually a way of reconciling things. There's a lot of there's we can't do it now because if you're 7 year old, if you come back from work one day and catch your 7 year old boy playing with his sister's Barbie, you're supposed to just take him along to the local hospital, have him pumped full of hormones. Dressing him like one of the Olsen twins, and turn him into a girl. And it is interesting to me that that's actually what they do in Saudi Arabia, for example. They have a much more they are repulsed by homosexuality, but they're generally more relaxed about turning men who feel that way into women. And when you look at this, I don't know whether it's not some... If I was one of these conspiracy-minded people, I'd say this is a way of squaring the circle on some of the internal contradictions of the Rainbow Coalition. That a man who is attracted to other men, in certain parts of the Muslim world, they say, oh, well, that's not a homosexual, that's a man who wants to be a woman. And they turn him into one. But we're not at, there's going to be something else. We're just destroying everything. So we've abolished marriage, we've abolished the sexes, the left will just be on to abolishing something else next. Andrew writes, Air Canada has done away with ladies and gentlemen and mesdames, messieurs. At the commencement of its messages when you board their planes to be inclusive. Thoughts? What took them so long? So Air Canada has now gone woke and they've abolished the sexes too. To go back to what I said at the beginning, people think, we're told that this doesn't, I was told when this started happening 5 years ago, this is a fringe thing. What do you mean transgender? I don't know any transgender. Who the hell wants to, you know, it didn't matter. We're supposed to be talking about, you know, Paul Ryan's likely speakership. Yeah, well, that was a waste of time. Every minute you spent talking about Paul Ryan is a waste of time. The left is all about big game. Mark Ferrigno says, it's mid-October, which means the brutal Afghan winter is right around the corner. Depressingly, for the 18th time, with all the focus on less than 100 troops pulling out of Syria, will we ever be out of Afghanistan, or should we gear up for the 19th brutal Afghan winter? I think C.S. Lewis, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Afghanistan is Narnia. It's always winter, never Christmas. It's really the first brutal Afghan winter. If you haven't read me on the brutal Afghan winter, that's in one of my books, because everyone was saying that Western troops wouldn't survive the brutal Afghan winter. This was in October 2001. It's 18 years later, and the weather is not the problem in Afghanistan. Mark adds, looking forward to the show in November. Yeah, we've got a couple of members-only events coming up in November. We're excited about them, and you can't come to them if you're not a member. So you got to be a member to come to them. And if you have been considering joining the Mark Stein Club, we may be doing a bit more of this in the future, because I think it's kind of fun. I like getting together with our club members. It's always fun to actually put a face to the people who ask questions on shows like this and the people who comment on various columns and things. It's always nice to put a face to them. And I'll be doing that next month at, I think, three Mark Stein Club events. So if you'd like to be part of that, then all you got to do is join the Mark Stein Club, and we would love to hear from you. And if you would like to come to that, don't leave it too long, because this is actually quite a small and select little gathering, because you'll be able to, for example, the first one, you'll be able to ask questions of my guest, and we'll have a book signing after. I'm sorry to go all a bit whistleblower on you, but because these are members-only events, we're not broadcasting them to the world quite yet. But you'll be able to be there. You're part of it. Ask questions of our whistleblower. You'll be able to get a book signed by the whistleblower. You'll be able to have a drink with the whistleblower. All you got to do is be a member of the Mark Stein Club. Jill Felsen says, Mark, now that every other word out of the cable talking heads is Ukraine, Ukraine, Ukraine. Yeah, the Ukraine girls really knock me out. They leave the West behind. Oh, what is that? Oh, Beatles, back in the USSR. The USSR's gone, but Ukraine is back. It breaks my heart that only Tucker Carlson has said anything about Ukraine as an actual country with actual people. Used to be almost 50 million until Russia grabbed Crimea, so now it's about 42 million. I have two wonderful grown daughters adopted from there 20 years ago and spent time there with real people who have remained dear friends. I feel so ashamed that our most powerful politicians can feel comfortable bragging about how they exploited this country for personal and political gain. More than 100 people were massacred in the Maidan demonstrations in 2014, and I don't think it even made the papers or the cable news over here. I guess Americans are fortunate that they don't have to know about or care about the rest of the world unless you're in the military and deployed. Are we back to the Cold War era when other countries were just pieces on the Cold War chessboard, except now the politicians get some money out of them along the way? That's well put, Jill. I think it goes back to what I was saying about Syria at the top of this show. Nobody's interested in Syria. The people who say, Trump has pulled American troops out of Syria, and they can't tell you anything about the intersection of the conflicts between Assad and ISIS and the Kurds and the whatever they are. I can't even remember the name now. I know more about it than, you know, a lot of people. I've forgotten the name of the autonomous region of anti-Assad forces, Iran, Turkey, Russia. Nobody can tell you anything about the intersection of these things, because the point is that Syria, like Ukraine, isn't a real place. It's just like a thing on a map that you can use as a cudgel for domestic politics. There are no real foreign policy issues here. They're essentially just, as you put it, chess pieces in domestic politics. And this has been true for this century. If you go back to all the things that people make fuss about, go back to Abu Ghraib, nobody really cares. Well, actually, go back to Iraq in general. Nobody really cares about Iraq. What they care about is using Iraq to clobber George W. Bush. Nobody cares about Syria. It's about using Syria to clobber to clobber Trump. So everyone's supposed to be an Turkey's. This is Trump's fault. Turkey's invaded Syria. So you're interested in Turco-Syrian issues, are you? Oh, couldn't care about them. Next week, Syria can invade Turkey, and then I'll all be standing up for our plucky Turkish friends who are currently the new stormtroopers. Exactly the same with Ukraine. But I think if you have any interest in the Ukrainian people, this idea that what Hunter Biden... Oh, it's not illegal. He didn't do anything illegal. Can you point me to the regulation or the rule that says the vice president's son shouldn't be getting onto the board of companies all around the world because of his last name? Well, the minute you need a rule to tell you you can't do that, it's over. The fact is, the Democrats purport to be the progressive people, the liberal people, the multicultural, internationalist people. As I say, the only thing that's changed, ever since this began, I've been saying that Joe Biden was getting $50,000 a month for a non-job in a country where the average salary is $200 a month. That's evil. All that's changed since I first deployed that line 3 weeks ago is that we now know he was actually getting substantially more than $50,000 a month. He was getting $75,000 a month. He was getting $120,000 a month. We don't know the ceiling. That's an evil man. That shows you the not just the humbug of these people, because he's actually part of the problem with the Ukraine is that you've got a political class and its cronies who steal everything to put in their Cypriot bank accounts. And that speaks very poorly for them. And it's why they elected this guy, this comedian who basically ran as he actually said, he ran as his country's Trump. So you've got these corrupt people stealing everything from the Ukraine. And among the people stealing is the vice president's son. And not the evil vice president of the evil Trump monster, but the good vice president of the beatific Obama, of the greatest president, the most progressive president ever in the history of everything. And his vice president's evil son is looting Ukraine. Because, as Jill says, these aren't real to them. Nobody cares about Ukraine now. There's no place called Ukraine. There's just Washington. And outside Washington, there's a zone called the rest of the country. And beyond the rest of the country is a zone called the rest of the world. And none of it has any meaning except for these stupid games in which the rest of the world has no purpose. They're like the native extras in an old British Empire ripping yarn. They're there just to make up the numbers. Who can tell one of them apart? You can't tell the difference. In the end, Kurds, Ukrainians, who cares? Was Joe Biden on the board of some big Kurdish company? Were the Ukrainians our plucky allies against ISIS? It doesn't matter. It's mad libs. They're just words to throw them all around. I've been going on a bit. Susan, I'll do one more question. Susan R. writes, I have a question regarding Brexit. There's much talk about the border between Ireland and the UK. I recognise that the shape and length are problematic. What about the border between Gibraltar and Spain? I know the border's quite small. I was in there recently and people go back and forth easily. Is Gibraltar just too small to talk about, or are there similar problems with that border in Brexit? Would be interested in your take. Well, it's all rubbish. It's all rubbish. Boris's sellout, if he's really going to sell out, right now the most important politicians in the UK are the 10 members of the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, because Boris needs to get them on board for selling out to this latest Brexit deal. The problem is that we've been told that having a border, a real border in Ireland, which would be the border between the European Union and the United Kingdom, is absolutely obnoxious. So now Brussels is offering to move that border to the Irish Sea. So that instead of having a hard border between the two parts of Ireland, you would have a hard border between a united Ireland and Great Britain. If the idea of a border in Ireland is obnoxious, why is the idea of a border between the two principal islands of the British Isles not obnoxious? Why, as you point out, why is the idea of a hard border between Gibraltar and Spain not obnoxious? Well, the answer to your question is that it's a phony issue. For example, let's suppose that on October 31st, Britain crashes out, so-called, of the EU with no deal. If the EU wants to assemble checkpoints on its side of the Irish border, it's free to do so, but there's no need, because on November the 1st, pending any dramatic legislation, both sides of that border have exactly the same regulatory environment and health standards and all the rest. So on November the 1st, anything heading south from Belfast to Dublin has exactly the same standards in Belfast as you do in Dublin. It's a non-issue. It's a non-issue which was used and this is my final thought for the day, because it gets to the heart of why the right gets suckered. In Britain, there was a supposedly conservative prime minister, Theresa May, who turned out to be the biggest flop. Theresa May, I'm confusing her with Theresa Heinz Kerry. Theresa May. And her prime ministership is a joke and a disaster and is reviled in memory. And why did it go wrong? Because on that issue of the Irish border, she accepted all the premises of the European Union. They were phony, bad faith premises that should not have been accepted. Now, I don't know how any self-respecting sovereign state can accept the ceding of significant sovereignty over one part of its territory. Boris Johnson called, I commented on this a few weeks ago, Boris Johnson called, he went England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, the awesome foursome, he called them, the awesome foursome. Well, one of those four is rather less awesome under the deal that's being talked about right now in London. And they are a very unequal foursome if this deal goes through. There will be an awesome trio and then an also-ran struggling away at the back. He said, Boris, that he didn't like the term prime minister. He preferred to see himself as minister of the union. If he does this, semi-severs Northern Ireland from the union, he will have done more damage to the union than anybody since the Black and Tans a century ago. And on that thought, that cheery thought, we are done. We are out of here. As I said, we got these special events, members-only events, coming up next month. Love to see you at them. We will have a ball. And we got three of them all in a row. And all we need to make them even better than they would be if we were doing them to an empty room or just into a television camera is to have Mark Stein Club members there in the room. We're looking forward to it. You can find more details about that at Stein Online. What day are we today? Wednesday. I'll see you on the telly with Tucker tomorrow. We have a brand new tale for our time. coming up very shortly. And some of the questions I didn't get to, we will get to, as we always do, in one of our video editions of Mark's Mailbox. I'll see you next time.